The next case is State versus Bedford. Again, State versus Bedford. Good morning, counsel.
Good morning. May it please the court.
You can take your mask off to argue, please, if you would. Thank you.
Yes, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is John Jorgensen. I'm from the Lancaster County Public Defender's Office. I'm here today representing Mr. Keith Bedford on his direct appeal. I have alleged on the brief here eight assigned errors. I would kind of like to bookend those in points here because I think in large part the assigned errors two through six all deal with ineffective counsel. And I think that they're in large part are incapable of being resolved on the direct appeal. And so would ask that in regards to those assigned errors that this court determined that the record is insufficient to resolve those assigned errors and therefore primarily focus on the remaining assigned errors. Then the seventh assigned error is sufficiency. And I would, I think, in large part, submit that assigned error on the brief. I'd like to primarily start with the last assigned error in regards to the error about the instruction or failure to properly instruct in regards to the self-defense request from defense counsel to have the jury be instructed that Mr. Bedford was defending himself. And I think that in large part, the analysis here is fairly straightforward. The requested instruction was a correct statement of the law. I don't think there's any question about that. It's our position that the requested instruction was warranted by the evidence because there is testimony in the record that Mr. Bedford was not the initial aggressor, whereas the alleged victim was advanced as being the initial aggressor, and that Mr. Bedford used reasonable force to protect himself from that aggressor.
And this instruction was requested with regard to the October 2019 incident only, correct?
That is correct, yes.
And was an actual proposed instruction submitted for the record?
That I don't immediately recall the transcript. I don't know that it was, but I don't know that it would necessarily matter for the purposes of the review here because the court has an independent obligation to instruct the jury in accordance with the appropriate law on the case. And if a requested instruction is advanced, then the court has that obligation, whether defense counsel provided a physical copy of an actual instruction.
I think trial counsel referred to the standard self-defense instruction.
Yes, out of NJI, I believe, was the...
That would be the implication, correct?
Yes, yes.
That it'd be out of NJI 2D, yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
And so obviously we're talking about then the standard form language is going to be accepted, reviewed, and therefore recognized as a correct statement of law. So again, then warranted by the evidence. Now, whether you believe Mr. Bedford or not about whether the alleged victim came up and pushed him and he had to push her back and whether she had shoved him up against the wall and cornered him when he was trying to leave or not, whether you believe that testimony or not is not immediately important because it's not the position of the trial court to place their own judgment of evaluating that particular testimony as to whether or not it's ultimately warranted. The fact remains that he needs a reasonable and good faith belief in the necessity of using that force, and he testified in accordance in that regard, and that the force must be used, the force used must be immediately necessary and justified. So here we have Mr. Bedford talking about how he was trying to leave. He was packing up his items. She cornered him and he pushed her back. She fell. Now, whether, again, believe that testimony or not was not something for the trial court. In fact, we can't even really give the trial court any real deference either under the standard of review or just in general, because it's, the record is the defense counsel requesting it, the court asking the state whether their position is, and they just simply advance, I don't think he's entitled to it. The court says, I don't think he is either.
But Mr. Jorgensen, it isn't a matter of just any evidence. There has to be some evidence that suggests a legally cognizable claim of self-defense. And your client's, by your client's own testimony, he said he pushed her. He admitted that he pushed her and that her falling was an accident. And I don't recall that there's anywhere in his testimony that he suggests that he felt immediately threatened or that it was necessary to hurt her in order to defend himself. I mean, can you point me to anything in the record that would indicate that based on his own testimony, he talks about apologizing because he pushed her. Someone typically doesn't apologize if they're feeling threatened, right, and they're protecting themselves.
Well, the apology in and of itself, I think, it is immaterial because he can, at the moment, feel it necessary to defend himself from her attack, push her, see the result of that. She's injured as a result of that, and he feels bad because he never had any intention of hurting her. And were it not but for her initial aggression, none of that would have necessarily occurred. And so I think we also have to contextualize this in the entirety of the evidence that's being adduced in this particular case, which also includes testimony that the jury heard about this alleged victim. When she gets mad, when she gets enraged at him, when she gets upset with him, she does things like throw rocks through windshields at vehicles. So I think the overall evidence here is not just did he say magic words of I felt it was reasonably necessary to push her to protect myself. It's just evaluating what the testimony was and whether that rose to the level of being warranted as to say that he
So let's isolate that here. So the testimony that you would suggest would support self-defense is that one line where he says that she pinned me against the wall. Is that enough to justify, did you get the self-defense instruction, you push somebody because they pinned you? Isn't that all we have?
One, I think that is sufficient. That's up for the jury to determine as to whether or not they deem that to be credible or appropriate for him in the amount of force that's used to repel that aggression. But it's also, again, I think we have to look at the information that the jury hears about the relationship between these two and what happens when one partner is getting upset with the other one. So the jury would have heard about this prior incident where she gets upset and is throwing rocks at vehicles. And I think that that's appropriate for that to also take into consideration in evaluating the defendant's state of mind in regards to whether or not he felt it was reasonably necessary to repel her initial aggression. And this incident between the two of them it completely transpired over a matter of seconds. And so in his description, he's only going to have limited means in order to describe that. There's only so many ways he can talk about what had happened on that particular day in that particular time. And I think it would be unreasonable and unfair to hold him to a standard to say that he didn't say a particular magic word. I think it's up for the jury to make that determination as to whether or not that was sufficient. And I think it's clear that he was prejudiced by the failure to have that instruction, and that was in regards to the fact that he was convicted of that particular count. And so I think that prejudice is inherent there in terms of the standard of review that's evaluated for the appropriateness of that instruction. But I also want to speak briefly, if I may, in regards to the first assigned error, and that's in regards to the impeachment, the attempted impeachment, and that pertains as to counts 1 and 2 primarily, that's in the information. Defense counsel had asked the child witness questions about previous statements made at the Child Advocacy Center and law enforcement there, things that involve statements, as we see from the offer of proof, that would have been in direct contrast to his trial testimony, namely that he didn't see the things that he said he saw when he came in and testified, and that his mother told him about the incident. And so the jury was never able to hear those inconsistent statements. And I think that if the jury had been able to hear that this child witness had made statements that they hadn't seen the things that they claimed to now have seen, and that their mother had in essence coached them into saying these things or telling them or helping them understand what had happened, I think that would have evaluated differently, or the jury would have evaluated that testimony differently, potentially not have convicted him on in regards to counts 1 and 2.
Did you direct us to those specific examples in your brief?
I see I'm out of time, if I may at least answer this question. I think it's sufficient that we've assigned the error and argued it. I don't know, without pulling out my brief here, exactly that we've cited a page and line number as for the attempted or the offer of proof. I think that my recollection was about midway through, I think, when there was when Cash was testifying, and that they attempted to make a record in regards to that. So maybe around page 400-ish in the Bill of Exceptions. But the record, I think, is there. Defense counsel, trial counsel, appropriately, I think, in some regards, raised that issue to the trial court, and the trial court's determination that that he failed to properly impeach is in direct contrast to the state Supreme Court in State versus Burton, the 282 Nebraska 125, I'm sorry, maybe 135, where they say that in the context of impeachment, trial court has considerable discretion in determining whether testimony is inconsistent with prior statements. And the court may find inconsistency in evasive answers, inability to recall, silence, or changes of position. So here, it's basically saying that in regards to the evasive answers can be sufficient for the impeachment of that witness. And so I think the trial court erred in making a determination that there was a failure to properly impeach child witness in this particular case, and would ask that the court so find. And sorry, I'm over time.
That's all right. Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Thank you.
How much should we take him over?
1 minute, 55 seconds.
If you could please add that to Mr. Lewis's time, please. Good morning.
Good morning.
May it please the court, Matt Lewis, Assistant Attorney General, appearing on behalf of the state of Nebraska. This is Mr. Bedford's direct appeal of his convictions of assault by strangulation, 2 counts of third degree domestic assault, prior offenses, and felony tampering with a witness. The final count charged Bedford as a habitual criminal. He now assigned several errors. This is mostly gone over, so I'll skip a recitation of that. I'll take these in sort of a reverse order of prior counsel, just to give it to handle the confrontation clause issue first, and sort of temporarily
there. If you wouldn't mind, I'm sorry to take you off your plan, but sure. Could you just jump into the self-defense?
Sure, yeah, argument? I can do that too.
Thank you.
Only where the jury could reasonably find that the defendant's use of force is justified should the trial court instruct the jury on self-defense, that state be case. That case also holds that to establish reversible error from a court's refusal to give a requested instruction, the appellant has the burden to show that, among other things, the tendered instruction is warranted by the evidence. I think this is where the state probably has the biggest problem with this error as assigned and argued. On that prong, a trial court is required to give the self-defense jury instruction where there is any evidence in support of a legally cognizable theory of self-defense. That is to say that Mr. Bedford must have had a reasonable and good faith belief in the necessity of using force, and the force used in defense must be immediately necessary and justified under the circumstances.
So stop it there. So I'm going to ask you the same question I asked him. So it looks to me like, he's been charged with assault. It relates to that injury, at least is in the October incident, right?
Yes.
Charged with assault, and it relates to this push, I guess.
Yes.
Based upon what he said, she came at me, she pinned me, I pushed her away, she tripped and fell. That's his version.
That is his version.
Is that not sufficient for self-defense? That push that he's describing was in relation to her having pinned him. Is that not enough? And if not, why not?
I don't believe so. I mean, looking into what could be considered reasonable and good faith, one. I think that you would need to look at the overall context of the events, even if you take it for how he presents it. In the sort of overall context of his testimony, that is the only thing that he provides, was that she, you know, comes up into his airspace pretty much and, you know, quote unquote, pins him against the wall, which he then responds by pushing. He does not provide any other testimony about what the immediate threat was, what could have happened after the pinning or the pushing, other instances where physical contact was initiated by her, other instances of violence, if she had a weapon in her hand, you know, anything like that, any verbal threats that came with it. It was simply that she pinned me and I pushed her. I would also like to point out that this stands in contrast to her recollection of the events, which is they got into a verbal argument. He went to go pack her stuff, or he went to go pack his stuff, and eventually threw a boot at her face. Her son, KW, also testified that they go into the room, they're arguing, they go into the room, they're still arguing, things get loud, and there's a loud smack up against the wall, consistent with, like, with something sounding like it was being thrown. So I think that within the context of the overall testimony, and if it is Mr. Bedford's burden, and all he is providing is, she pinned me up against the wall, that's my version of events, I don't have anything else to back
up. So if there's a different version, you know, there's a different version, yeah. But his version,
sure,
you know, is that she got hurt because I pushed her, she tripped and fell because she initially pinned me. If his version alone, notwithstanding other people's versions, is sufficient to warrant the instruction, doesn't the court give the instruction?
If his version of events was sufficient, and again, I think it is the state's position that it is not sufficient because there's just not enough sort of meat on that skeleton in order to develop
She pinned me is not enough.
Right. It does not provide the reasonable and good faith belief. It does not provide that his actions then were immediately necessary. It doesn't provide that it was justified under the circumstances. And I think that you also have, you know, sort of the credibility problem of, you know, the story versus that story.
Plus, didn't he testify that she initially stopped him from leaving and pushed him against the door initially, and he got away from her in that instance, so there was some evidence that he was able to extricate himself, right, without engaging any sort of violent actions. Right. So is that enough, though, to just follow up on what Judge Welch has been asking? So if somebody is pinned in order to use force against the other person, one, that needs to be perceived as unlawful force against the person, sure, right? But there needs to be an immediate threat and need to engage in some measure of force. I don't recall that he testified to being afraid or threatened in any way by her.
Correct. And I'm not, let me set my own self sort of straight here. I'm not saying that if somebody gets pinned up against the wall, that by itself is not sufficient to create a self-defense situation. I mean, you know, I'm sure we could get into several hypotheticals where, you know, if somebody, you know, bigger than me, or, you know, more aggressive than me, or somebody that I had bad blood with, or, you know, in the context of a bar fight where there's, you know, drinking or maybe weapons or thoughts of weapons or something like that involved, and you get into a situation where you get pinned up against the wall, and, you know, that creates a lot more context. I think that the pinning by itself, and given sort of the dynamics between the two and what the trial court had heard up to that point about their relationship and the physicality of the relationship, I don't think that it meets the standard that is articulated in case put out by the Supreme Court. If no further questions on that, I will jump to the confrontation clause assignment of error. It is the state's primary argument that this argument was assigned, but not specifically argued. I think at one point in the appellant's brief, he says that, you know, the trial counsel should have been able to impeach the victim and KW. I was not able to find any instances where that was the case where there was an attempted impeachment beyond just normal cross-examination of the victim. There is that one instance of attempted impeachment of KW, but there is also the interesting caveat to that where defense counsel does not try to impeach KW. He tries to impeach KW through the testimony of one of the responding officers to the, I believe it's the October assault, or no, it's the April assault that takes place at the grandmother's house. So there's some back and forth as to whether or not that can even happen, to try to impeach a witness, impeach somebody that's not on the stand who's been called as a witness, and using that as a tunnel, you know, to sort of get there, you know, with obvious hearsay problems. And then the trial court says, well, you can call that witness back. You can call KW back and you can, you know, get him back on the stand and you can impeach him there. Trial counsel indicates that he is going to do something along that line, but it never, you know, never materializes. And so I would say that there's even potentially a waiver problem, whereas, you know, he's provided with an outlet to do it. I'm not even sure if you can have the impeachment to occur the way that it did through the officer. But then also you have testimony from several other people about KW's whereabouts at that assault, what he saw versus what he says that he saw. The grandmother says, I thought that he was in the back room playing on a video game. I don't think that he saw anything that was happening out the front window. She talks about that more than once. So I would even go as far to say that the credibility of KW and what he saw during that assault is called into question through other witnesses, and that in light of that, the appellant hasn't really shown what it is they were going to ask, what was going to be brought out, how it was going to change what had already been established, the testimony of other witnesses, and then also KW himself, who you know, is given plenty of opportunities on cross-examination and does sort of waffle at times about what it was that he saw.
Can I ask you about one of the ineffective assistance of counsel claims?
Absolutely.
The appellant's claim about the emails and the text messages, do you believe that that was set forth with enough specifics for us to even consider it?
In my brief, I argue that no, and I'll go further into that and say that, you know, there's no real identification as to what the emails were, you know, specific content, number, format, date, even relevance of, you know, the text and emails. There's not a whole lot there. There's just the assertion that they exist. They would have helped him at trial for impeachment purposes, and that everything would have been different had they been admitted. They are talked about. I'm not sure if they're talked about in front of the jury. It might have been as a, you know, just an aside, but they are sort of addressed during testimony, that they exist and some of the stuff that's out there. And it sounds like it just purely gives the witness credibility too.
Are you familiar with the Supreme Court's somewhat recent decision in State versus Blake, where they address some of these ineffective assistance of counsel claims?
Yeah.
Okay. Yes. Do you, in your opinion, did it give greater leeway in how these types of claims must be raised?
I would argue no. I would have to go back and take a look at the opinion again.
Do you see this particular ineffective assistance claim as to exhibits being different than where the Supreme Court has talked about if you identify certain witnesses and you name the witnesses, we don't necessarily need to know everything they would have said? Do you see this as distinguishable from that?
Yes, I think that this isn't just identifying a witness that could have been called that maybe even is a part of the case or something along those lines, but this is arguing about materials that are out there, just sort of nebulously out there, in the form of text messages and emails. I mean, and I think in any case, you know, you're going to have text messages and emails and phone calls and all sorts of stuff, and you can assert that that stuff is out there, but I think that you need to show a bit more of, maybe not necessarily specifically, you know, text message, you know, 67 says this, and then present the case as if you're before a trial court again. But I think that you need to provide a little bit more about what the content is, and why that's important and why that's relevant.
And what I was just going to say, what difference it would have made had it come in, right?
Correct.
The Supreme Court's talked about no placeholders.
Right.
Right. And so just saying, well, there's exhibits, text stuff out there that would make a difference.
Yeah, there's evidence out there.
That's a placeholder.
Yeah, exactly. If there are no further questions on the ineffective assistance of counsel claims, I'll leave those on the brief, and then I will do likewise with the sufficiency of the evidence claims unless there are specific questions from this court.
Good.
Anything else?
All right. Well, the state asks you to affirm, and thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you both very much. The matter is submitted, and we are adjourned.